Hello, and welcome to the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative to record America's family history in sound. Oral histories are one of the most personal and rewarding ways to preserve family stories. The Tell Me a Story sessions are 45-minute interviews between two people with the assistance of a trained facilitator. Participants will receive a compact disc with the full interview. A copy will be archived at the Midwest Genealogy Center and, with permission, later made available to the public. And now, another story.
My name is Jim Nunley, and I have the fortune today to talk to a group of people who have experienced bowling. And not only bowling in the typical roll down the lane way, but bowling in a way that is unique. It's unique of the lost history. And not the lost history of bowling per se, but the lost history of those who were kind of on the other side of the segregation line. And our hope today is to retrieve that history. Once someone said that history is so insufficient in telling the story, what is sufficient today, we'll hear that story from people who have experienced what it meant to be black, what it meant to be black and a bowler, and what it meant to be black and a bowler in a time when things were segregated, separate, and maybe a little bit unequal. So we're going to talk with Maxine Walker, who was a lady who has been credited with actually getting the men to actually bowl. So we're going to learn today that it was really the women who really started bowling first. And then we'll hear from, along with Alex Harris, who has been a real premier bowling along the line, having experienced great national fame in the field of bowling when it really wasn't popular for a black person to be bowling. So we're going to get into this today. We're going to introduce Maxine Walker. Say hi, Maxine.
Hi.
And then Alex Harris, huh? No, Baker. Why am I saying Walker? Baker. And Maxine Baker. Say hi, Maxine.
Hi.
Okay, and then Alex Harris, whom I've known for a number of years. Say hi, Alex.
Hi.
All right, very good. And we're going to go down the line here. We're going to talk a little bit about you, and then we're going to talk about what it was like to live in segregated times. And then we're going to talk about the recreation of bowling, and then we'll talk about some of the bowling houses, and then we'll talk about integration, was it good or bad. But we just want to have a conversation so that this history will be recorded. It is so insufficiently recorded, and we want to correct that today. Okay?
Okay.
Maxine, tell us about you.
Well, my name is Maxine Houston Lewis Baker, and I went to school here in Kansas City, Missouri, and Wichita, Kansas. And doing... to cut it short, I was first introduced to bowling lane during World War II when they began to hire blacks to set pins. And so some of us females, we decided we would go and set pins and play more, which we did. And that's how I was exposed first.
All right, how old are you now, Maxine?
I'm 84.
84. Mm-hmm. And so when you said World War II, what period of time were we talking about?
Well, it was during the segregation, but in Kansas City, it was our Wichita. I guess it wasn't as bad as living, you know, further south.
Okay.
You didn't have the public accommodation; you just went to, you know, black places, and you attended in Kansas City. You attended all black schools, and in Wichita, Kansas, which I think the last grade that I was there in was about the sixth. I didn't get to go to junior high. If I had, it was mixed in Wichita, Kansas. But I came back to Missouri, and I graduated from grade school at Attucks and went to R.T. Coles.
Okay,
and they called that junior high for
me. Were you born here?
No, I was born in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Lawton, Oklahoma.
But they left there when I was 3 months old, so I don't...
All you've ever known is Kansas.
I don't know anything about that. Then they went to Arkansas, and that's where my sister was born.
Okay.
And then they went to Muskogee. That's where my mother and father separated. And my aunt, my mother's sister, came and got us and moved us to Wichita. So after divorce, we went between the father and the mother. My father was in Kansas City, Missouri, and my mother was in Wichita, Kansas.
Okay, we got that. Let's get into Alex. Alex, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, I was born in Kistler, West Virginia, 1930.
Right.
And I stayed
You're
in Kistler.
East Coast kid.
Yeah, Appalachian Mountains.
Yeah.
That was the poor years of that part of the country. Okay. Coal miners.
That's right. Close to Pennsylvania there.
My father died this about 1996, and he was at that time the oldest coal miner in the country. He was 101 years old.
Wow.
And I came up in the coal mine field till I came to Kansas City at the age of 6 with my auntie and stayed 1 year. Went back home, stayed until I was 12, and that was during the time that the North America bomber plant was opening up and was hiring people for World War II, okay? And my dad moved here, and he brought the family with him, and he wanted his sons going to the coal mine.
What year are we talking about here?
That was from 1940 to 46,
okay?
At that time, I came to Kansas City, I was 14 years old.
Okay.
My dad was working at the bomber plant. And I was going to school here, which I started at Gates and went to R.T. Coles High School.
Okay.
And proudly, I can say that, I became one of the street hustlers on 12th Street. At that time, what number 12th Street and 18th Street that you could go to.
Okay.
And we was all of the blacks in Kansas City was locked into Independence Avenue to 19th Street from Truce to Cleveland.
Okay. All right. Before you go too far into that, with the war, what happened when the war ended?
What happened when the war ended?
Yeah. I mean, was that a good time or a bad time? Now we're going to kind of move into this segregation.
It was a good time in the environment that you was allowed to stay in. It was a good time for that territorial environment that I knew, which was I just described to you. Outside of that, I don't really know, because at that time Kansas City was pure racist, okay? And blacks did not go outside of those geographical boundaries I just told you, nor did they live outside, nor did they go to school out. And all of our young folks who was in school and good athletes had to compete among each other, so they would eliminate themselves by competing with each other. Therefore, they didn't have no competition with the outside white schools.
That's right. Would you say that's true, Maxine, as you as well?
Very much so.
And what was your experience? You went to all black schools as well?
I went to all black schools.
And what were they again, you mentioned?
I went to Alex, that was elementary, and Winter Phillips. And then I went to R.T. Coles, which was the junior high school and the trade school combined.
Okay.
I stayed there only 1 year, then I went to Lincoln. And after I graduated, they had a junior college. That's where you went to junior college also. So I just stayed there. I went to junior college 1 year. Mm-hmm. Then I went to
What year are we talking about here?
Oh, my goodness. Let me. It had to be, I came out, I think, in 43. Because I was with the last of the mid-years. I came out in January, I believe, in 1943. And looked like I did spend that 1 year in junior college. Then I moved and went to Chicago.
And we talked about that.
Married.
What was the difference between Chicago and Kansas City in these segregated times?
It was a great big difference.
Okay.
I was like, I couldn't believe the sort of things I could, do in Chicago. You just felt free.
Yeah, because there were so many blacks. Right?
It was so many blacks, and no one really paid any attention, you could go wherever you wanted to go. So that was a big difference. And then when I came back to Kansas City, I was locked in again with only, the blacks. Several would go shopping. And, and when you go at that time you went places where it wasn't any black, you would stare down. And
in Kansas City or Chicago?
Kansas City.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right. Now, Alex, you painted a picture coming from the East, or at least the Appalachia area, and whatever. Did you feel victimized here as a black person in Kansas
City? Yeah, as I grew, I learned from the public awareness that the most racist part of the country was supposed to be the Appalachian Mountains. Mm-hmm. But when I came from West Virginia, I was 12, 13 years old, and I had better treatment by the blacks, by the whites, coal miners and the white mothers in West Virginia than I did the same in Kansas City, Missouri. I didn't meet any whites individuals outside of my community until I was 18 almost in Kansas City, Missouri.
Wow.
Okay? And so it was a change for me that I had to adjust to because I had had freedom with whites, coal miners, and et cetera, in West Virginia, and allegedly the most racist part of the country. However, I came to Kansas City, and it wound up being worse than West Virginia.
All right.
Okay? So it was a tremendous change for me as relates to, and for the black community, and that was during a time when blacks could not go outside of the geographical area, and believe it or not, at my point of time, and as I just heard Mr. Baker talk, I remember signs downtown said blacks are whites. So my mother was working downtown at Kresge's, and Mine Green.
Mm-hmm.
And we had places downtown that we could Kresge's, and you had to stand in line for blacks, stand in line for whites.
Right.
Kresge's was at 12th and Main. And the only time we got outside the community when we went downtown to visit our parents who was working down there as laborers and maids and et cetera. Okay, so you know that was during at that particular time. I went into the service in 1951 and I came out in 1955. I went served in Korea, and we went into construction business. My dad was a paper hanger, and we started hanging paper. My dad and I, my brother, hang paper all over the country. I mean, all over the city, and we started construction company.
So you've been kind of an entrepreneur all your life.
Yeah, I worked for myself all my life.
And does that come from your father?
Yes, I was one of the fortunate blacks that had a father that was sitting with his son every morning who was teaching me. Now, unlike most of our kids now, they don't have a father, but then. Back in those days, the father was very conscientious about their kids and would teach them, and that was the period of time we had the RT codes.
Mm-hmm.
RT codes is the business essence, the last vintage of businesses that black businesses in the total of Kansas City was RT codes graduates.
Mm-hmm. That's the high school. That was the junior high, you said.
Junior high. RT codes was where you went to take a trade. You could stay there and graduate academia with a trade, or you leave there and go to Lincoln High School for academia only.
All right, hold up there just a minute. Let's get Maxine in here. Maxine, Alex has kind of described to us what it was like to be black and male, and he was very entrepreneurial. What was it like to be black and female in these times?
Well, for some reason, it wasn't quite as hard as it's on the male for the female. I knew places I could go and couldn't go, so I just didn't.
I just didn't go.
So more or less, you just stay within the black neighbors for your entertainment, and because at the theaters, I think we had three here in Kansas City. We had one on 12th Street and two on 18th.
And what were their names?
I remember the Gym Theater. The Lincoln was our best theater, and
castle.
On 12th Street was a castle, 12th and Basale. And we used to call it the Gym. We go there for the rat race.
Now the Gym Theater is big,
It's the only place we had to go at. And most of the convergent place in Kansas City was the Bowl at 12th and Passale.
Okay, we're going to get the Bowl in there.
Yeah.
Just
no,
minute.
The Bowl.
The Bowl?
The Bowl itself. That's the round.
Oh,
circle.
Okay.
And that's where all of the young folk from 18th Street and from 12th Street would converge. That was a gathering area because we didn't have no other place to go.
Right.
Okay? For those of us that was too young to go into clubs and things, that's where we all wind up.
Okay, so describe this geographical area you spoke to several times.
On the north, it was Independence Avenue.
On the south,
it was 19th Street.
19th.
On the east, it was Cleveland Jackson. and on the west it was Troost Avenue.
Okay. And that was the area.
That was the black folks' area.
Okay. Now, we've heard 27th Street being referred to as the southern boundary, and he said 19th. Maxine, yeah. Does that make a difference?
But during my time, even before the war started here in Kansas City, we were on 12th Street to... We stayed like that until the war, 12th Street to about 19th Street. Then when the war started, we advanced to 27th Street.
Okay.
But it was no blacks across 27th. It was one, a doctor. It was two houses. I'll never forget, on Brooklyn. It was only two places across.
See, the blacks,
south of 27th Street.
Yeah, the blacks migrated past 19th Street when North America bomber plant over. That was during the war, and all of the ones was coming in.
Yeah,
okay,
they
to
came.
Work,
but it
start
was
buying homes south yeah. of 19th Street.
But in some areas we was already past, because don't forget Lincoln. They built Lincoln High School was on Woodland, and I remember when they built Lincoln High School.
There were Lincoln, mm-hmm. but Lincoln between 19th and 25th Street. 21st Street, yeah.
And 22nd.
Yeah.
Okay. 22nd.
Because
right. I used to live in 1910 Woodland, and that's how I know where it was sitting up there on the hill.
All right. We got a good grasp here of the times now. I mean, we're in wartime. We're very much segregated. We've got some geographical boundaries. We have people kind of working in somewhat menial jobs and whatever. Okay, now, so, and you mentioned the... Alex, about the bowl, and it's kind of ironic that we would say the bowl when we're going to start talking about bowling. Now, what was done recreationally? What did you have to do at these times? I mean, what kind of recreation was there in Kansas City in these period of 40s and 50s? Tell me.
Well, from my understanding, the way I looked at it, during those days, we would get out of school, we'd come home and do our chores. And our folk took pride, especially the female, took pride in cleaning up and putting themselves up so the fellas could holler at them during the evening. Okay,
I don't know if that's changed.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's unlike now, there's a different groomness of the females. At that time, we didn't have anywhere but the bowl to go to, like now, Soul Parkway. I mean, out at the Soul Park Zoo and all of that, we didn't have that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All we had was the bowl and the parks and recreation facility up and down Paseo. Most people don't know it. Paseo Boulevard was the main street in Kansas City, Missouri for black folks.
Okay.
Okay. And the oldest house in the city is on 11th, 10th, and Paseo, the house beside the road. All right. And that's a historical spot, but everything was on Paseo Boulevard, and those of us who lived on Paseo Boulevard, we thought we was in heaven.
Okay.
And I was a couple of blocks from Yates School. I went to Yates School, and then I left there and went to R.T. Coles. Okay. And
but what was going on? Are you saying Paseo was the recreation center?
Paseo was the focus point for black folks, because everything Paseo had to do was between 12th Street and 18th Street. Paseo Boulevard was the street that went from one to the other.
Okay. Is that the same with you, Maxine?
Well, similar. I guess he's forgotten. We could go to the zoo, but it was what area in there we could go. And that was across where they housed the animals. And I remember when I was in high school, I guess it was Farson, someone must have had a car, and we was out there one night. And they made us leave because we disturbed the animals.
Yeah, we had
now, I laugh about that, but that must have been a very demeaning kind of thing.
It was, but I laugh, you know, when I think about that now. Because as he talked, then things are coming back to me. I said, yeah, we used to go out there. Yeah. And we used to go on Parade Park also. And every Sunday night, they had a concert out there, and people would be laying around with their blankets and listening, you know, to the music. And sometimes they would just stay out there and sleep the rest of the night.
See, at that time, everyone's house in Kansas City in that geographical area was wide open. There wasn't no locks.
No, you didn't lock your door. You just walk out and close your door.
And you could live all night long out in the Paseo Park, because Mr. Leo Davis was the band master, who brought all of the young folks who could play music to the, they had a deal set up in the middle of the, right at 15th of Purcell. And Sunday night was the night that all of the black folks come together and would listen to the music being played by these musicians that came out of RT Cole School. Okay? And so that was the part of the recreation. The other part was the nightclub. Some of the most fabulous nightclubs in the country was right here. Most people don't know that Lester Young, Hot Lips Page, Hodges played saxophone with Duke. All of the top stars that you've heard of played at 18th and Van, okay, at the Shaperie. And we couldn't go because we weren't old enough, okay?
Tell me about Count Basie there.
Well, I was kind of young for Count Basie, but Count Basie came here, and I got to go in one of the famous places they had was Lucille.
Yeah.
But my father carried me in there, so I didn't.
You were protected.
I put on heels and stockings, and so I did go to Lucille's.
Very good.
Our thing at the time was music. Yeah. Okay, and I was got into music because I was in the band with Mr. David, Leo Davis, at R.T. Coe's. That's where I was taking music. Okay. And he had some of the top musicians in the world was taught by Mr. Davis. Okay, Miles Davis, Parker. As a matter of fact, Parker used one of my friends.
Parker is, just for the listening trip. Parker is Charlie Parker.
Charlie Yardbird Parker would come to Kansas City and his horn would be in Pine in New York, and Mr. Davis would take one of our young folks' horn in the class and give it to Charlie and Miles Davis to play on the weekend when they'd come in Kansas City.
Wow, that is
they come in Kansas City and a lot of them played at the Playmore Bowl. And after they went through the crisis of Cab Calloway getting beat up out there and almost started a major riot in Kansas City.
Wow. Yeah, Maxie, what do you say about that? And then we're going to go into the bowling alleys here now, because you know, we got a little idea of kind of like what life was like, and then we kind of see the jazz age, and we see recreation, and we see all that. Now let's kind of move a little more specifically to bowling. Okay, what were the bowling houses like?
We only had one.
Okay, and which was that?
It was two.
Now we're talking 50s, 60s? What are we talking now?
We're talking now 50s.
Okay.
And actually, I don't know what part. It may have been like 49. I think the one on 18th Street that I went in there once. It was a bowling lane there.
Where about 18th?
Off of Truce on 18th Street.
Right on the corner.
No, it wasn't on the corner. It was kind of midway.
Because yeah,
it was
a drugstore on the corner. Wasn't that the one you could go upstairs to?
It was on street level.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
What was the name?
I don't even know the name.
Okay.
And the next bowling lane, where it used
to be. Remember.
That I remember.
Marlon.
It used to be a night club there on Vine between 18th and 9th. Street, Monarch Bowl.
Okay, Monarch.
Okay. And before then, it was a duck pen. When I was in high school, that was a duck pen lane.
Okay,
I think you rolled three balls. The balls, the pins are real small, and the ball is small. You get to roll three balls to knock off. That's the way I remember.
How many lanes?
Oh, in there, it was only eight lanes.
Okay, so it was relatively small.
Yeah.
What else went on in the bowling alley?
Nothing else.
They
had
bowl.
Food.
How much did it cost?
I think I remember to bowl, it cost 10 cents.
Okay.
And the food probably, I don't have a slice of it.
What kind of food did they sell?
Well, they had ice cream, sandwiches, and they had Coke. See, I had a fountain. That's where, you know, the average place.
So it's kind of a recreation center.
Yeah.
I mean, had a lot of
you have to understand, 18th and Van was a commerce, a black commerce, that was equal to Country Club Plaza.
Okay.
For black folks.
Oh.
Because 12th and Purcell was a commerce district. Everything that you wanted in there, you could get in there. Hot dogs, steaks, restaurants, you know, merchandise, automobile deal. All of that was confined.
So that was the economic center.
That was the economic center. 12th and Vine and 18th and Vine was the economic focus of black folks.
So here comes Monarch Bowl right in the middle of that.
Well, after all, because during the war, it used to be, before the war, it used to be a movie house,
okay.
Monarch Bowl. And Benny went to a nightclub. And after the war, that's when they changed the duck pins, and finally it went into regular bowling.
Right. Were you guys bowlers at that time?
Well, no.
Okay, when did you become bowler?
I bowled one game at Monarch Bowl, and I didn't like the atmosphere as young as I didn't particularly like. And the reason I didn't like the atmosphere, I think I was probably 18 or 19. I didn't like the atmosphere because it gave me that second-class feeling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I wanted more. I was always ambitious. I wanted the best. I had visited some of my white friends who had all of these pretty places. And I couldn't
have it. Bowling establishment?
Yeah. Okay. I didn't knock it. And I'm saying, why couldn't we have it in our neighborhood? Okay. So I bowled one game in Monarch Bowl, and that was it until I had a chance to become the manager of Rhythm Lane Bowling Alley in year 1960. Okay. But from there back for 15 years, because I didn't get started bowling until I was 30 because there was no place to bowl.
Okay, so in your conversation here, Maxie, we seem to kind of get it that there was maybe a second-class feeling about Monarch. Was that true with you?
No, it didn't bother me.
Okay,
because I wanted to bowl. Okay. And I started there in 1950.
Okay.
Of bowling.
Yeah, but that's saying a lot for those individuals who bowled in that period.
Okay.
By someone like me who saw the difference and they didn't have no place.
Okay. So you're saying it was usually okay for those who
it was a place where I saw a lot of greatness come out of second classism.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
A lot of greatness came out of in that second classism didn't show up until later.
Talent.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Tell me about now. Then we're in this period, we're now at Monarch, and where to from there? What was the next bowling establishment that you bowled in?
No, you want to stay there for a little while.
Okay.
Because, like I say, I started bowling there. I came back from Chicago, and then I found out it was a bowling lane, and I went to Monarch Bowl. And I started bowling there in 1950, and it was the latter part of 1951. We had three Caucasians, female, that came in. And we was wondering, some of the people, why they was there. And the first time they came, they just said, well, they spoke and sat around. Then they returned again, and they asked us if we had any junior bowlers. And they actually showed us how to set up a junior league for the younger people. Then they returned again, and they said, do you guys know anything about organized bowling, which we did not know anything about. Then they let us know that in Chicago, it was a suit and had been sued and had been handed down by the courts that black could join organized bowling for the female WIBC, for the male ABC.
Oh.
And so they also brought us forms to fill out. And we had to pay, for whatever that fee was at that time. And then later on, they said, would you like to bowl in the city tournament? And we tried to get the black men. They wouldn't join. We were the ones that joined. We were the ones. 20 women. And it was kind of heartbreaking that they wouldn't join. Anyway, they bought us entry blanks to bowl in the city. Oh, we were so happy we were going to bowl in the city. But we didn't know what we was getting into.
Okay. So it looked good, and then what happened?
I got my papers here. On Saturday, February the 16th, 1952, at 6 p.m., Plaza Bowl, we were scheduled to bowl. We went there, and it was four teams. And I'm going to name these teams. Geneva Beauty Box was in Class A, and Metro Cleaners Class A. And we had the Bachelor Club and Nightingale Tavern. They were in Class B. But still, we right there, bowling.
You're in there. Now, which was your team? What was your team?
Geneva's Beauty Box.
Okay,
we bowled on lanes 17 through 20. Lanes 21 through 24, they turned out the lights from the bowling pit's ceiling all the way.
To keep you from...
Separate.
They separate us, and the tournament picked up again at lane 25.
Is that right? Now tell me what you felt that. I mean, here's somebody just outwardly being.
We were really shocked because then we found out
what did you do?
He didn't want us to bowl, the owner. And they said we can't help. They have to bowl. It's the law.
Playmore Bowl was where they beat a Cab Calloway.
Yeah, but it wasn't there where we bowled. We bowled at Plaza Bowl.
Plaza Bowl, yeah.
Yeah, that's
so tell me about this. Tell me about you just being outwardly discriminated.
Yeah, I guess it made us angry. We got there and
did you kick some butt?
We bowled good. No, we came in first place, Geneva's Beauty Box. And we had a score of 27-17, and we held that position until the last squad, that last night, on the last squad, Jimmy Mary Steakhouse won. And then in the meantime, the women was walking around and said, we don't care who wins, so these ends don't win. Uh-huh. And we constantly heard that end.
What is in?
All the time.
Okay.
And see, the success of the retaliation was not this. The retaliation was not fussing back. The retaliation was not challenging the guy. The retaliation was outdoing him.
Oh, okay.
Now,
explain that, because that is very hard.
I'll give you an example.
You could be in a bad situation, and then it become the
But we were smarter than that. Okay. I'll tell you why. I remember turning specifically that I had a Mr. Lambert, who owned the bowling alley. He said, son, use your head. I was in a tournament where there was all whites, and I was the only one there. He said, use your head and make them angry. And I've been over at the thing, and I said to the white boys who was on the lane with me, boy, I'm going to whoop your butt. Mm-hmm. They all got angry, and I couldn't touch none of them physically, but I beat them just because. And that was the retaliation we had. Like I told you,
at that time
we had the Kansas City Monarchs and Joe Standard Service. Okay, all of the old guys. You had Maxine Dim, who was beating all of the women. We couldn't say nothing about it, and we couldn't retaliate. But when we got on the lanes and we got to compete against them, that's why they didn't want us around, additionally to being black.
But you have just captured exactly what this recording is supposed to do, is to tell the untold story. And I think you got to make that very clear about how you used a bad thing to make it a good thing. I mean, to make it turn you on, to make you motivated. Tell me more about that.
Well, it's sort of a psychological thing. You are competing, and Maxine and all of them went into it, JC and all of them. And you're being treated like dogs, okay? And the only way you had to retaliate without going to jail if you raised some cane was to beat them. And that was a motivation. It became an inner motivation to just make them look bad.
Was that true of you, Maxine?
Well, yeah, because we went on to, as I say to me and then John, and the following latter part of that year, 1952, went to the state tournament in Springfield. And we were in Geneva's Beauty Box in the B division. We won that division outright. We won that. We didn't lose that, you know, later on, but we won it. But in the state of Missouri, it was no public accommodation. Mm-hmm. So what the state secretary would do, she would go to our lawyers, our doctors, and tell them to go to the blacks and see who would give us a room when St. Louis, Missouri, and Kansas City come in. And that's what they did. We did that for about,
Let me get this right. So when you went to another town, namely Springfield, though you could not be accommodated by the hotels and the motels?
No restaurants.
And you had to go where to stay?
Stay in homes.
Yes. Stay at home or sleep in your car sometimes.
And they wasn't too nice, some of them sometimes. And usually when they had the state tournament, it used to be real cold. And we would be like, it would be snowing every time when Kansas City and later on St. Louis, you know, joined. Because actually, I have to explain this. When we joined in Kansas City, Missouri, the 20 women, no one else. We were the first 20 in the state of Missouri.
You were the pioneers.
Blacks,
right.
You know, to join. So we did this up until the year we went to Sedalia. And we went to their luncheon. We surprised them we was there.
Surprised them, what does that mean?
The organization, they always used to have it on the kickoff would be a luncheon. So we were there at this luncheon. And so when it was over, we went out on the highway trying to make reservation in the motels. Some accepted us, but then they would get a telephone call and they say no. So what we did, we returned back to the bowling lane at the headquarters there in Sedalia, and we told the state secretary that we were no longer going into black homes, that she's going to have to do something about it or it will be another suit.
All right, now.
And she did. What happened at the time, the largest hotel in Sedalia, I don't remember the name of it, they gave us a floor for St. Louis and Kansas City, and they let us eat in the coffee restaurant, I think they used to call them there. Area restaurant, too small restaurant.
Did that seem victorious to you?
Yeah, because we did win, so you couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, but about staying.
That was a step. I mean, you,
that was a
you
step
felt,
forward.
I mean, you know, we felt like you being moved, respected.
You moved the needle.
We're paying our way, we're not betting.
Yeah.
Only place, and it was surprising because we had been warned about Rollin Missouri. Rollin Missouri actually accepted us in their hotel without an argument. Exactly. And there was a white restaurant we went down there. They never said a thing to us. Only said to us, at one time they had one black family that had lived. Rollin Missouri, actually, they treated us okay.
All right, now I'm going to ask you both questions in a minute as we draw this to a close. Was integration bad? In other words, as you look forward, you look on your times, you look on your past, you look on those motivating moments that you have. But before that, let me give you, Alex, a final time here to talk about, you know, what she talked about. Did you ever experience just blatant segregation or discrimination along the way? Blatant.
Yeah.
Tell us a couple of them.
Well, yeah, but it was after the period of time that Boland had segregation had ended. This Jim and I was working for around the Bowen Island, Mr. Walter Lambader. Okay. And he made a machine out of me. I wasn't a gifted bowler like Joe and Ron and all of them. I was a machine. I was a robot. And I turned professional. And the first bowling that I did was in Dallas, Texas. Okay. North Dallas, you know, you heard of North Dallas.
Yeah.
North Dallas, there's no black folks show up in North Dallas, period. Mm-hmm. Here I am showing up at a 100-lane bowling alley, okay, and one tournament in an area where black folks didn't go and happened to be the king of the tournament because I won.
Right.
And the end result was the king and the queen had to dance and kick one another. And so in North Dallas, I was black and she was white. And Mr. Lampetta got me out of Dallas that night, okay, and there was many nights that I was, because I didn't like being a pro, but getting in what was the pro bowl at that, because there were only two of us out there, there were myself and Jay Weber Sims, and everywhere we went, you was either sleeping in the cars or sleeping with somebody in the neighborhood that was black, otherwise you couldn't, and that was even after they had integrated all the bowl now.
50, 60?
Now, this was in the between 60 and 65.
Oh. Cool.
Okay. It was still great, the segregation went on, even though they had opened up the bowling, like Maxine said. We was, and our satisfaction was kicking butts.
You're right.
From being better than there.
Right.
You know, it was no different than the Monarchs who played baseball. The same thing with the bowlers. Okay. The first best bowler in the country came from Chicago, J. Weber Sims, but the best bowler was J.C. Collins.
Here in Kansas City.
So you had that combination of things where the only satisfaction we got was kicking butts after being better than they were, okay? And they had all of the everything, and they had lounges and everything else, so we had to get out after you get your ball and disappear, boys, you know.
And so when you hear North Dallas, it has a whole new meaning for you, right? Very good. Let's try to pull this together. Heard an awful lot from you today. I'm moved by what it is you feel, but also what you've done. I think the historical value here is that somebody way away from you, years from your age, won't really understand that there was a time when there was a completely segregated society. And you seem to live through it. You seem to have benefited from it. But most important, I would expect you to be a little bit more bitter than maybe what you have said today. But based on that, if life was kind of good with segregation, is integration a good thing or bad thing? Or put it the other way, was segregation all that bad?
It's sure how you look at that. And being the manager of a bowling alley, one of the things that I was always cognizant of was the young folk. We had to have young folks come along. And during the time that we had the bowling alley exclusively, you had youth leagues and youth training classes. And from that standpoint, when the integration came, that ended because there was no more special training classes for our young folks that diminished the amount of competent bowlers as compared to the populace, okay?
So you can understand Richard Williams the way
it was good, and it was both good and bad. It was opened up to all of the populace of bowling, but it hurt the generation of blacks coming along because there was no training classes other than what was in the black bowling alley.
What did it do to those economic centers you mentioned?
To the
economic centers at 12th Street and at 18th Street. What did it do?
The 12th Street and 18th Street had died by then.
Okay.
Or they were dead because integration just
that's what I said.
Destroyed that,
so integration kind of took them out.
It destroyed that commerce system on 18th and Vine.
Are you mad about that?
Huh?
Are you mad about?
Not really. It's just according to what part of the life that you talk about.
Okay.
I can look at the part with Joe Newsom and that group, Ron River, and be proud. I can look at a lot of things in certain areas, but when you get my age, you start worrying about your young folks and the follow-up afterwards. And some of those things were destroyed because they destroyed our unity, 18th and Vine and 24th.
Destroyed our unity.
Yeah, destroyed.
It also destroyed the black family unity because, the younger people began to leave home. Once upon a time, you stayed home until you got married. Mm-hmm. You just didn't leave home. And so that made a big, separation. So, I don't know. And I didn't particular, I was afraid for the children when they went to school, because I'll never forget, it was a white woman on the bus, and she was teaching at Central High. She talked about black people on that bus. I couldn't believe the thing she was saying, a teacher. So I knew then the kids, they just wouldn't been taught. They wouldn't be.
See, that was those of us that have been militant all our life. I was a militant back in the army.
What does militant mean?
Militant means anti-angry, anything you said that was wrong or oppressed against our mother, our father, our sister, our brother, or denied
for
us.
For being black.
I had to speak about it.
Okay.
Most folks would speak about it. I just had to say something, so I became a militant. Okay? Anything I didn't like, I said something about it. I saw my dad get beat up by organized labor because he had three sons doing construction work on properties that the union says that we couldn't work on. Mm. Come along and kick the ladder along, So it was kind of hard.
Are you still angry?
Yeah, so, I got over the bitterness, but I didn't stop talking, okay? And as of today, I still speak to those things that I think are unfair to our young folk. And most certainly now that the system, good thing about the system now is that our young blacks and whites are coming together. Back in our days, black and whites was kept separate. That's a good part, okay? And so you ask how you feel? It was those who felt was suppressed and was afraid to say something. There was those who were so busy trying to survive that they couldn't say nothing because they were. Then there were those of us who had the freedom to shoot craps and play pool and have a luxurious life on 12th and 18th Street. Then we said something because nobody could do anything against us. Could nobody stop me
from
shooting
craps? So you
were
independent, right?
Yeah. You couldn't stop me from shooting craps, I made money. You couldn't stop me from shooting pool, I made money. I made money without having to go to work. Everybody else that had a job bet not to say nothing.
Again, your answer to Bruce. Final word. You may.
I don't know. I'm not bitter. As you get older, you change. But I was always a militant myself because I'm always, no matter where I was, if the man crossed me, I would speak back. And they would get my mother and they would be so frightened sometimes. It would shut me up. But I always had something to say, and I still have something to say.
You see, one of the persons that I always admired was J.C. Collins. See, J.C. didn't have the ability to talk back, but he had the ability to beat your butt on the lines.
All right. That's okay. Good. Again, what you're talking about, the being the motivating factor.
And so he went through that. J.C. went through a lifetime of that at Armco Steel. He retired from Armco Steel. And it was the most prejudiced place in the country, okay? And he would leave Armco Steel and come out. And most of the bowlers today owe their knowledge, those of the good bowlers, know the senior bowlers who've been good, they owe J.C. because J.C. was the tutor. Fuss at you, argue at you, curse you out, but he would train you. Okay?
Again, you said that's part of what we lost all this process. Unless you got something, can you give me a final word and we'll end this miraculous interview? It has been moving in every way.
Well, you know, I would certainly hope that, and I want to say this, I certainly would hope that the importance of the women who first started went out, aside from the men with Maxine, don't be forgotten. I certainly hope that the Midwest Bowlers Guild realizes where they were born and how it spread it. The fact that we've had some tremendous successes of individuals that the comparison of Team Black here was comparison to the best team in the world, which is the Budweiser bowling team, and the accomplishment of the young folks. Joe Newsom, you know, we never told him because we didn't want to get the big head, but it was the best we had out there after the period of time. Ron Winfrey went out was the first black youngster from Kansas City. And when I went out there, I was old because I was in my late 30s. They was out there when they was 18 and 20. And the fact that we had, after there was the bowlers, bowling was spread out and ABC started, Joe Standing went across the country and beat everybody out there, everybody, the professional bowlers. And I distinctly remember one night when myself, JC, and Ronald matched up with three of the best bowlers in the country in rhythm lanes, and they left at the end of the sixth frame.
Final word.
Well, I'm glad to see that bowling have advanced and that we have quite a few females that's can 200 average. I never dreamed I would ever see that. So I've never been a high average bowler. I just average. I think my average at one time was, I was bowling with a bunch of men, and this probably aided me. I think one time my average was 180. It was in a mixed league, but beyond that, I never really did anything outstanding, no more than art, just like I say, up in for my rights to bowl and to live, you know, in certain areas.
And there are certain people we should really highlight, Mr. Walton, okay? Well, Mr. Walton.
Al Walton,
J.C. Collins, Maxine, Lil Green, Ulysses Long, okay?
Okay.
Those people shouldn't be forgotten because they played a tremendous role in the progress of blacks and bowling, okay? And,
all right. Let's end this interview. It has been fantastic. All right.